From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. I'm Abby Klein.
And I'm Elena Canelopoulou.
We are currently master's students studying city resilience design and management at the Universitat Internacional de Catalunya. Today we will be continuing the series of student takeovers in this episode of Urban Resilience Dialogues, where we will be talking about heritage within the field of urban resilience. As I reflect on heritage, I'm reminded of the stories and traditions passed down from my parents and grandparents, or the awe-inspiring sites I've encountered across the globe. But heritage isn't just stories, traditions, and places. There is knowledge woven into these narratives. These places connect people and bring them together. Heritage teaches us skills passed down through generations and can create value, meaning, identity, and culture within communities. We believe this is why we've seen the topic of heritage gaining momentum in recent years. Heritage is fundamental to urban resilience as it can guide us to adapt and respond in the face of the growing climate emergency. Growing up, my grandmother's stories were more than just bedtime tales. They were lessons in resilience for the real world. In today's episode, we'll explore both cultural heritage and heritage sites within the theme of urban resilience. We'll delve into our own experiences and look at a few cases from around the world.
To explore the topic of heritage further, we are joined by Joanna Venados. Joanna is a city resilience and climate finance advisor for the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy. While she helps bring climate change mitigation and resilience projects to life. Originally from Colombia, she obtained a bachelor's degree in architecture and a master's degree in urban planning from the National University of Colombia. Joanna has also held various positions within the United Nations and has a successful track record in development affairs.
So Joanna, we'd love to start by learning a bit about your story. What brought you into the field of urban resilience?
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here today and to be part of this conversation. And I want to start by saying that I have a lot of questions myself. So this is a great space to build on our curiosity and those deep questions that keep moving us forward. What brought me to resilience? And I think that I was thinking about that a while ago, and I think that it's like adding up different pieces of the story. I didn't make the straight decision to go into resilience, but I was getting there by building from the different pieces. As you mentioned, I'm an architect. I studied urbanism. I'm very passionate about cities, but I also work with the environment, with indicators, with development plans and progress, and disaster risk reduction. And building up on all those pieces, I realized that there's something that needs to bring everything together. And resilience for me is a dialogue that comes from multiple levels. If we talk from the national, global, subnational, local, community level, but we also need to think about the different scopes that we need to embrace when we're talking about resilience. We need to talk about capacities, we need to talk about budget, we need to talk about buildings, we need to talk about how we think and we plan the city for the future. So I think that one of the key things that keeps me talking about resilience is it's the time, because I think that we build the time that we are transforming in each of us in a different way, and that builds that resonates in different levels. So resilience, it's also about the time that we have to act and to bring all the pieces together to shape the future that we want to achieve and dream and pursue.
Absolutely. I love your perspective of resilience. And since we're talking about heritage today, we'd love to know how heritage contributes to the work that you engage in.
I chose the heritage, like the guiding work for this conversation, because I started working with Heritage when I was working in Panama with the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, and we were working with we developed a tool to measure resilience and how heritage can be affected by it. So the topic caught my attention because it also came on a personal time when I was trying to understand my identity and how that relates to the spaces that I've been moving or the countries that I've been moving. As you said at the beginning, I'm Colombian, but I lived in Panama for 13 years. Now I'm living in Spain. So my life is built from different pieces and different cultures. And I think that heritage brings us the value, the identity, and it's like, it for me, it's a deep root that we need to take care of, even though it's not always visible or out shining in the light. So how does it engage with the work that I'm currently doing? I think that it keeps being a question because I need to bring it to the things that I'm doing. I'm my heritage. I'm coming from all those that came before me. And I keep thinking on how to honor the past that we have and the future that we have. So it's more on a personal question than directly related to the documents or the everyday work that I'm doing now.
Thank you for that. Heritage is quite a personal and unique topic. I'd like to dive into the topic of cultural heritage by shining a spotlight on a pressing challenge faced in Bangladesh. In this region, sacred flowers play a pivotal role in religious ceremonies. However, the harsh impacts of climate change resulting in heightened soil salinity and recurrent droughts have taken a toll on the cultivation of these holy flowers. Consequently, ceremonies in the region are under threat. In a study by the International Institute for Environment and Development and the International Center for Climate Change and Development, this example is identified as a type of non-economic loss and damage, depicting the ways in which customs and cultural rights are threatened by the intensifying effects of climate change. What are your reflections on this? What significance does it hold when our heritage becomes vulnerable to disasters and climate change?
That's a very interesting question, because it touches that intangible part of the heritage. We talk about tangible and intangible, and there are a lot of values that build on that intangible piece, that it's critical to build us as communities and as individuals. So when we talk about that intangible piece of the heritage, we talk about the landscapes, I don't know the word in English for this, but it's like the ritos is in Spanish, and all those moments that we treasure as memories. And that also comes from the finding the right elements that can make those things happen, like music or like flowers, like food, like smells. So it all comes together. Definitely climate change is posing a big challenge to keeping all those little, I say littles in the sense of subtle, you know, like small things that are not that noticeable, but that really have a huge impact. And the question that comes to my mind is, what can we do to protect those invisible things? What will be the role of us as individuals, but us as communities, to build on that and to be able to create a space that can help us maintain those little and powerful things?
While the influences of climate change are felt all over the world, it often feels like we lack control over the consequences. We can see this in Bangladesh, where the population contributes less than 1% to global greenhouse gas emissions. So similar to the questions that you brought up, in light of this, how do you envision communities actively contributing to the preservation of their heritage? What role can they play in building resilience amidst these challenges?
I think that communities are playing a huge role, protecting, preserving, and conserving the heritage, the intangible traditions that we can pass from generations to generations. But I think that also they are the ones that that hold the power to act within their own territory. That might sound contradictory because that's not always the case, and there are a lot of different forces and drivers that that make that change. But I think that communities, and I had this conversation a while ago with a dear colleague. It's like if communities have the power to maintain the drive and push forward little actions that can call to local governments to act, that voice will resonate and replicate. So if we as a community take care of the space that we're holding, it can give us the power to keep building upon on that. There's also like very, very successful stories of the power of communities changing decisions. We recently saw with the COP28 how, well, that's another topic, we can deep dive into that later, but how the reactions and the voices of a big number of stakeholders, actors, national governments actually managed to change an outcome that was not what was expected. So I think that definitely empowered communities have the power to build, take care, protect, and host the change, but also, I mean, to host the space that we need to preserve, but also to trigger the change. Communities are also drivers of change as individuals too.
Another place we've seen cultural heritage affected by climate change is Uganda, where flooding has hindered rituals that typically occur at the Nile River. So facing this harsh reality of heritage destruction that we know will occur time and time again, how can we take proactive steps and adapt to rebuild what has been lost, or what might be the ways in which we can develop a cultural memory of those rituals and heritage that we lost due to climate change?
I think that documenting, it's a very valuable strategy. If we as a community have the vision to gather that knowledge, to preserve it, and to be able to share it with future generations, that's good. And we can do that with photography. I'm a photographer too, so I'm thinking about the wonderful images that can help us share those stories in time. But of course, systematizing those learning, there's a lot of intangible knowledge there. As we speak, for example, for the use of medicines, natural medicines in different places of the world that can help us heal communities or help the people. So we need to keep track of that, to be able to preserve it, to have like a guardian of that knowledge, and find a way to keep it. That brings me to the part of the tangible heritage, and I'm guessing that the question is, how can we translate that intangible heritage and knowledge into tangible? And I don't know if you have something to share with us, some ideas. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's also important to document, like you mentioned. I mean, just from my personal experience, my grandmother, for example, taught me a lot about cooking. So while she was still alive, we would cook together, and I would often, you know, write down the recipes as we would go, so I could preserve those recipes and then teach those recipes to my children. So yeah, I think documenting is very helpful to pass down those traditions and information.
You made me think also about all this beautiful handwork and craft that comes from different parts of the world, and there is also this I don't know what would be the word, but maybe there's not so much interest from new generations, from younger generations, to learn those hand working moments, to build a basket or to thread or to sew, and that is also that we also that is something that we also need to take care of, to learn and to pass.
So now shifting our focus to Europe, it's interesting to know the strong emphasis on preservation, especially when it comes to the built environment. In Greece, for example, it does not appear that some monuments are in immediate danger. However, we must act proactively. The effects of climate change may develop slowly upon our heritage sites, but air pollution, especially in the past 20 years, has already caused damage to monuments located within the city in the area of Acropolis. The Parthenon and the ports of Caryatides have been damaged due to moisture, causing corrosion on the outer surface of the marble. As you can see, there are monuments all around us that we need to take care of. We forget that maybe we have to secure our past first and then look to preserve a better future for our communities. How could communities be impacted when they lose their heritage and cultural sites? What are the deeper impacts of losing our past, our heritage, and what can we learn from efforts to preserve built environment heritage sites?
How could communities be impacted? I think that that's a big question when we think. Just let me go to another question. Do you imagine a future where you don't know anything about the past? How would that be if we don't learn from our past, if we don't learn from the things that work or didn't work? How can we move forward? We will be repeating the same mistakes, and we'll be losing the same thing. And that's what I also said at the beginning, that time it's a big piece of the conversation, because we, without learnings from the past, we will be, yes, repeating the mistakes. So just imagine that we would have like all the same culture without the riches would be the word. No, I don't know the word in English. But what will make us be us? What will make us be different? And I think that that question goes into a very deep conversation, not only about how to preserve, but also how to prepare for the future, how we take care of what we need to safeguard. Who will be the responsible? The community, the governments, stakeholders, universities, I don't know, UNESCO or some other entities that are taking care of our heritage. For me, a community that loses their past, loses a very big and deep root. And I think that we have seen that also with the displaced populations that are moving because of climate change or because of violence or because of personal reasons and decisions. So we always need a guiding light to help us move forward and not repeat the mistakes that we did in the past.
It's known that climate change affecting heritage sites with extreme weather conditions like floods, droughts, storms, earthquakes, wildfires, or even greenhouse gas emissions. However, climate change is not the only threat. And indeed, we see the tragic loss of heritage and cultural sites very often in situations of conflict or in wars. Demolishing, destroying, dismantling someone else's culture and heritage is tragically used as a tactic to annihilate the sense of cultural identity. Or on the other hand, to try and forget the past. For example, the demolition of the Berlin Wall comes to mind, or the demolition of communist statues across the country of the Iron Curtain during the late 80s, early 90s, as well as much more recent wars. In Syria, the World Heritage sites have suffered considerable and sometimes irreversible damage. Four of them were being used for military purposes or have been transformed into battlefields. Palmyra, the Crag de Sevilles, the St. Simon Church in the ancient village of northern Syria, and Aleppo, including Aleppo Citadel, destroying the inheritance of the past robs, future generations, a powerful legacy, deepens hatred and despair, and undermines attempt to foster peace. What is there to be done when faced with this military tactic of destruction? Do any examples of good peace and reconciliation process come to mind? For examples, well, cultural heritage is used to heal and aid peace processes.
That's also a very hard question to go, because there are a lot of power forces that are behind those decisions, and those are very hard to influence. And I'm guessing that when those moments come, the power of communities to protect their heritage is not enough. I mean, global voices can raise to condemn those situations. And for sure, it's a shame that we're losing all that, those examples, all those sites. So I think that it's a very painful moment for communities and for us as humanity to lose all that that cultural value. You made me think about this reconciliation spaces or opportunities, and I was reflecting on that. Two examples came to my mind, both from Colombia, and there is a wonderful place that it's called Caño Cristales, which is a river that has seven colors. So for a long time, there was no way to get there because all that area was controlled by the guerrillas. There was a lot of argument around that because they said that because it was controlled by them, the site was protected. It didn't have, as far as I know, but maybe I'm wrong, a specific cultural value related to some ancient story or stuff like that. But that site became like a symbol of the places that Colombians could not visit because we were in this huge conflict. So when the peace came and everyone was able to go there, it was like a national joy to be able to be there, because it's a beautiful place. It's a river where you see seven colors on the bottom, surrounded by mountains. So visiting that place was a moment of reconciliation for the society. And there is another piece that there's this Colombian artist that's called Doris Salcedo. And when the peace treaties were signed, it was like, okay, we need to do something to commemorate this. And they got all the guns from the guerrilla, because they were part of the deals that they had to give back their weapons. So she melted all that, and they went and they got a beautiful house in Bogota, in the center of the city. And then she said, okay, I want to make a monument, but I don't want to make a monument that is vertical and that stands like power. So she took out the power of those weapons, melted them, and make planks, metal planks that were hammered by women that had sexual violence, that had suffered sexual violence because of the war. So they hammered all those metal planks and they put it in the floor of this space. So the symbol of violence that were the weapons were transformed by the pain of these women to a foundation where a lot of cultural things happen. And that is also a space for reconciliation. That it's the space where we go and commemorate and we remember all the violence that we went through as a country. But I think that she was very clever to remove the bad meaning of that vertical, cold and terrible weapon, putting the pain of the women there, but opening the space for things to happen. So I think that culture, art, heritage, and all these transformation pieces can really make the space to a peaceful future, and a future that we dream and that we will to get there.
Very nice example, thank you. So we've been discussing this double dynamic of protecting and conserving sites, while on the other hand, military tactics to destroy cultures and identity through destroying heritage sites. Do you think there's anything else we could do to protect our heritage sites? Are there any trade-offs between different protection measures? Often easier to focus on specific sites rather than the broader cultural context. Should we approach protection measures for heritage sites separately or as a whole to ensure effective adaptation solutions for our sites?
I think that in an ideal world, everything will be interconnected, right? And the decisions that we make in one space could trigger different actions and decisions to protect, build, and restore. Unfortunately, that's not the case yet. And I think that that's why we are here, because I think that heritage and resilience, there's still a lot to do. There is a huge space there that needs to put that needs us to put our brain or hands or hearts to find a way to make that reality. So when we think about conservation or preservation of our heritage, we need to engage with communities, we need to engage with traditional knowledge, we need to engage with the youth, we need to engage with local governments, with the institutions, national governments too, with global institutions too. So we need to build that net that help us bring the attention to the relevance of protecting heritage, because we are putting a lot of attention to build conversations and define some actions, but we need also to preserve what we already have and that has a great value for the future that we dream. And as you see, I've been saying a lot of the future that we dream, because I think that we need to dream it to achieve it. And that's where time comes. So we need to have that time in our perspective to know and be aware that we're just making small steps that can be faster, of course. But we need to keep that the perspective of we need to make the different connections. When we talk about protecting heritage, let's think about the fire in Paris, in Notre Dame. They act very quickly because they knew what to do. They had a plan. But there are some other cases where we talk about disaster risk reduction, and there's like an earthquake, and then the church collapses, and then everyone comes, try to get things, or the someone comes with a fire extinguisher and just drops that into the paintings and they damage. So there's a lot of culture and learning there that we need to do from the communities, the first responders, the national local entities to build or to bring cultural heritage into the broader conversation. That is how we build resilience and how we build a sustainable just future for everyone.
Building on our previous conversation and recognizing the need to make strategic choices, how do we decide what we deem as valuable, and how can we choose which aspects of heritage to preserve?
That's also a very hard question, because I think that heritage comes with time. It's time that decides what is preserved, and it's not an individual decision. It's a collective one, because we keep preserving some pieces of that. So it comes with time. Now, what should we preserve? Landscapes? Of course, we need to preserve landscapes because they have a deep value. Should we present intangible cultural heritage? Of course we do, because that's our songs, our foods, our smells. Should we preserve paintings, monuments? We should be able to preserve everything, actually. but yes, it comes with time. And I'm wondering, what will you pass to your future generations, to the future generations from your own culture? If you had to choose one thing, maybe it's the food that you learned to cook with your grandma. Maybe it's, I don't know, a fabric that was sewn by your grandmother. I don't know. How do you choose? What do you want to preserve for future generations? And of course, that's a broader conversation when we talk about countries, global level, or cities, or even collections of art, museums. How can we choose? That's very hard.
Yeah, it's true. Now, the final question, it's more fun, trust me, it's not that hard as the other ones. So give us a little prediction. What do you foresee as the future of urban resilience and heritage preservation?
I think that urban resilience is growing and is gaining momentum. And we're talking about, in my personal perspective, in my career, I started talking about resilience, talking from the disaster risk reduction side. And now I'm talking about heritage, I'm talking about climate resilience, I'm talking about social resilience. So it keeps growing. And as I said before, there's still a big question there about how heritage sits in the resilience dialogue. We're also seeing that in traditional knowledge are also gaining more and more space in the global climate conversation. So it will come for sure. And because if we are not aware of our differences, how can we move forward? There's a moment in time that where all the pieces come together, and then you realize that your roots come from far, far away, from different places. And that is what builds you, and that's what makes you move forward, even though it's not tangible all the time. So for me, it should be a must. I would love to see more things happening in that space, because as I said at the beginning, I have a lot of questions. How do we keep what we already have? How do we translate that to other generations? How we document and systematize, how we share all the richness that we have. How do we keep it? And how do we keep it in this moment where there's a lot of things changing and there are a lot of game players and stakeholders that are focusing their attention in the future that we want and that we can achieve?
John, thank you so much for joining us today. To our audience, thank you for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues, and we will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com, or you can tweet us
with the hashtag URDialogues.
Chat to you soon.